Good afternoon, everybody. This is Barb Pello, Group Director at InfoTrends, and I'm delighted that you could join us today for our webinar titled On Demand is In Demand for Books. And I want to give a special thanks to Canon Solutions America for sponsoring this webinar. You know, for the past few years, the industry has been talking about a shift in digital book manufacturing, and it's driven by changing balance sheets and the publisher's needs to better manage their inventory. Well, publishers' needs have existed for quite a while. The challenge has been the right technologies capable of achieving things like quality, speed, flexibility, affordability, for equivalent to offset printing. What you're going to hear today are a number of different perspectives on the market. We'll talk about what's going on in the book market. We're going to talk about some of the emerging technologies for book production. You're going to hear perspectives from the independent publishing side as well as the manufacturing side. And one of the most exciting things that we've got today as well is that BISG just published today their book stats, and so we'll be discussing those as well. And so the presenters that are part of the webinar today are, first of all, Nadine Vassallo, and she's the project manager for research and information from BISG, Angela Bowl, who's the executive director for the Independent Book Publishers Association, and John Edwards, who's the president of Edwards Brothers Malloy. Before we get started, what I would like to do is just make sure that you all have the right tips to successfully enjoy the webinar. First of all, if anybody is having technical difficulties, you can let us know by using the Q&A box, or you can troubleshoot by clicking the help widget below. If you've got a question, and we'll be taking questions throughout the webinar, just submit them via the Q&A box. Make sure that you've disabled pop-up blockers. And if you want to see what the console can do, you can click on the Tips for Attendees widget for a complete rundown. Now for our agenda for the day. I'm going to spend just a couple minutes talking about what we see in publishing in terms of digital disruption. I'm excited to have Nadine here. She's going to share with you the latest and greatest industry stats. You're going to get a perspective from Angela about what independent publishers are looking for relative to their needs and requirements. And John's going to wrap up with a manufacturing point of view relative to how the manufacturers are equipping to meet the needs of the changing market dynamics. First and foremost, I think everybody will agree that the publishing market is in a state of disruption. Publishers want to go after new revenue streams as ebook revenue growth continues to taper. In 2013, what we're seeing is ebooks hit an inflection. And so what you've got are a number of different mechanisms where publishers are looking for mechanisms and ways to innovate, offer new products, services, and solutions. What we need to do, though, is we need to look at this digital disruption as a transformation. And what you're seeing is it's kind of like the caterpillar transforming into a butterfly. You're going to take the paper books, and you're going to have to not replace them, but in some instances blend them with new technologies, things like rich media that will make that book in an electronic form even more and more interactive. And so what we'll be doing today is really talking about both the challenges and the opportunities out there. And what I'm going to do is start by turning it over to Nadine, who's going to share with us what's happening in the book market. Nadine, take it away.
Great. Thanks, Barb. And good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for calling in today. As you now know, my name is Nadine Vassallo. I'm the project manager for research and information at the Book Industry Study Group, BISG. And today I'll be presenting some general industry trends we've observed over the past few years from a publisher and a consumer point of view. But before I dive into those numbers, I wanted to give you just a little bit of background about BISG, who we are, and what we do. So BISG is a trade association, but unlike a lot of other associations in the industry, we actually represent all sectors and verticals. So our membership includes trade, education, and scholarly publishers, as well as retailers, wholesalers, librarians, printers, and so on, both large and small. And our work centers around research, education, and the development of standards and best practices. The way I like to think about it is that BISG wants to help everyone in the industry to do business in a smarter, more grounded, and data-driven way. Hence, one of our primary goals is to provide the sort of trusted, comprehensive industry research that I'll present. So as Barb mentioned, just today, in fact, we published the latest volume of our flagship publication, Bookstats, which is produced in partnership with the Association of American Publishers. What Bookstats is an extrapolated view of the full size and scope of publishing in the U.S. on an annual basis and across a variety of formats, channels, and subject categories. The new numbers released today cover through the end of calendar year 2013. And it's important to keep in mind when you're looking at any of this data that it is all publisher sales. So nothing I'm going to show you represents retail or point of sale data. This is all going to be at PublisherNet, the publisher perspective. So how big is the publishing industry overall? Well, there are about 60,000 currently active publishers, most of those very small and producing just a few titles per year. But altogether, that universe earns about $27 billion a year in revenue. And this is a trend that we've observed pretty steadily through the course of the Bookstats project. As you can see here, we've hovered right around that $27 billion point in revenue for the past 6 years. There should actually be a little 27.0 on the 2013 column. Not sure what happened to that. But anyway, we think that this is actually pretty good news. With generally flat sales, we see the book industry continuing to fare better than some other traditionally print-based content industries that suffered much more significant losses during the transition to digital media. And in even more good news, book units sold in 2013 were actually completely flat compared with 2012, coming in at 2.6 billion net units for the second year in a row. And the reason why we think this is particularly good news is because it suggests that even with the falling, slightly falling revenues we just saw, there doesn't appear to be any associated decline in readership overall. This is even more striking and I would say downright impressive when you consider that 2012 was really one of the biggest publishing years ever, with huge sales generated by certain blockbuster series like The Hunger Games and 50 Shades of Grey. So the fact that unit sales didn't drop off between 2012 and 2013, like we might have expected, means the health of our industry overall isn't determined by just those sort of outliers, but actually by a lot of different successes coming from a lot of different places, and ultimately by the success of the whole long tail. So if we're seeing unit sales flat, but revenues slightly down, why would that be? I think if you think about it for a moment, it should be fairly obvious. This is really all about price. And this is particularly an area where ebooks have had a large impact. We've seen pretty steeply falling ebook prices, and the average amount that publishers earn from an ebook sale fell last year for the fifth year in a row. It's now down to $6.52. If you look back at the first year on that chart, 2008, you can see that it was over $20, and it continues to fall each year. While the amounts earned from hardcover and softcover sales have stayed relatively flat, and in fact, as you can see here, both were up just very slightly over 2012. So this is definitely one area where digital has shown a really profound impact.
Nadine, we have a question from the audience.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if BISG tracks this, but the question came in, what's the difference in what the publisher can make on an e-version versus a printed version? And do you capture that data?
We don't.
So in other words, if I'm getting $6 versus $10,
right,
do I still make a good margin?
You know, that's not actually something that we track. Everything we track is kind of just it's publisher average net unit price. So
okay.
It doesn't really take into consideration what the profit earned is there, if that makes sense. But you can see here kind of the difference between what they earn on average between those different formats. We don't track it at the level of specific ISBNs to the extent where we could say, you know, this one book did better in hardcover versus ebook, though.
Thanks.
Sure. So moving on, Bookstats also tracks four major categories. We track the trade market, which comprises general consumer fiction and nonfiction and religion. learning materials for the K-12 and higher ed market, and professional and scholarly books. As you can see here, trade is by far the largest sector we track, with about $14.5 billion in sales last year. Back in 2012, as I mentioned, we saw a real explosion in trade fiction sales, thanks largely to those few runaway titles. But without one blockbuster novel to rule them all in 2013, we saw a return to form for nonfiction, which picked up almost $250 million in sales compared with 2012. I think this is one of the most interesting charts we have. This shows which categories experienced losses and which saw gains last year. So along with adult nonfiction, you can see that the education markets, especially K-12, made a big comeback last year. And I think it's also interesting that this chart is actually almost the exact opposite of what we saw when we compared 2011 to 2012, when the fiction categories performed extremely well at the expense of nonfiction and education. So we kind of saw a swing back last year away from fiction and towards nonfiction. What you see on the screen now is the trend of total trade sales for 2008 to 2013. And this is broken out by physical formats in the blue and digital formats in red. You can see here the growth that trade experienced in digital over the past several years. But interestingly, and maybe surprisingly, digital growth has actually stalled in the trade sector. If you compare 2012 with 2013 here, you can see that digital and physical sales both dropped down just a little bit, accounting for an overall decline. Whereas if you compare 2011 with 2012, you can see a lot of new digital sales coming in while print was flat. So actually, if you consider the ebook growth rate for 2012 to 2013, for the trade, it was nil. We actually saw totally flat digital sales comparing those 2 years. So it seems clear here that print is far from dead. In fact, trade publishing remains just 23% digital, and print sales still account for about 75% of revenues overall. But when you break this out by individual formats, you see a little bit of a different story. It seems clear ebooks are here to stay, even if it's only as kind of the new mass market paperback. Here, if you compare these lines, you can see ebooks have completely overtaken the mass market format, although they still have a ways to go before they catch up with either hardcover or softcover, which have stayed pretty flat across the top. And this is even more striking if you look just at adult fiction, where you can see ebooks actually have overtaken any other single format type. In adult fiction, ebooks now account for 40% of revenues and about $2 billion in sales. So what we've seen here is really all from the perspective of publisher sales, but I think it's important when we look at this trend that we consider the perspective of readers, too. So I wanted to share just a bit of data from a survey that BISG did called Consumer Attitudes Toward Ebook Reading. This was conducted from 2010 to 2013, and it looked at the habits and behaviors of ebook buyers specifically. Over the course of this survey, we really watched the typical ebook buyer mature, and I don't just mean that they got older. For the first time in 2013, we saw a majority reporting they had been in the ebook market for at least a year. So they're becoming more settled, the novelty is kind of wearing off, and we're having an easier time understanding their buying and reading habits. The general habits they're settling into tend to mix some amount of both print and digital formats. So as you can see in this chart, a little over 40% of ebook readers report they mostly buy ebooks and buy less print books than they used to. Another 33% say they mix the formats interchangeably with no real preference for one or the other. But we're not seeing nearly as many readers who seem to strictly prefer either E or P. They're all kind of mixing between the two depending on the genre, the particular book, or any number of other factors. We also asked them why do they buy ebooks, and probably not surprisingly, considering some of the price data that we saw earlier, portability, readability, and convenience, ease of acquisition, they're all factors for them, but really it's all about price. Affordability consistently comes out on top when asking why someone reads an ebook. And you can see that the average amount they're willing to pay is consistently falling. On this chart, we compare how they rated different price points. And if you kind of follow between that red and orange line, that's between reasonably priced and so expensive I wouldn't buy it, that's kind of the sweet spot of what they're willing to spend. You can see it drops off pretty consistently about each year. That's now down from around $12 to $17 back in 2010 to around $6 to $12 in 2013. We also ask about the genres of books that they're interested in. This is just in general, not in E or P, and we see a pretty wide range. There's some of the genre fiction that you might expect, like sci-fi, mysteries, and thrillers, but there's also a lot of literary fiction, travel guides, cookbooks, and more. So we know these are a pretty diverse group of readers with diverse interests. But when you ask what sort of books they prefer in digital rather than print formats, you get a different story. You can see the things we might readily expect, like genre fiction, things that have traditionally been published in the mass market format that we've kind of seen ebooks replace. Those all come in at the top in the area where they're preferring E over P. But as you move down the chart, and as you move towards the preference for print rather than digital, you see the preference has started to shift away from those fiction categories and towards nonfiction like how-to guides, travels, and cookbooks. Similarly, when we ask about the sorts of enhanced functionality readers might be interested in, things like the ability to lend ebooks, which you see at the top, end up doing well, but things like video, high-quality charts and tables, things we might associate, again, with nonfiction rather than fiction, don't perform as highly. So just like we've seen from the publisher point of view in book stats, ebooks are really taking off when it comes to certain types of books that line up with certain types of reading behaviors. And I think of these behaviors as those that most seamlessly translate from page to screen. So when you're talking about someone that really likes to read mysteries, for example, you might have a reader who just wants to get to the next page and find out what happens next. They're not going to notice whether they're actually physically turning the page or just flicking the screen of their tablet. But someone who really loves big, beautiful cookbooks filled with images of all the great food they're going to get to make, they might not be able to get that same experience leafing through their cookbook on a device. They might want to see that in print. Or they might be better served by downloading a recipe online and not consulting a traditional cookbook at all. So I think what we're seeing here, like I said, is a split between the parts of the industry that are best suited towards moving digitally and those that aren't. What we're not seeing is any real significant cannibalization of print sales in general by the emergence of digital formats, really for any other category except for the mass market paperback.
We've got a quick question here.
Yeah.
One of the things when you talk about the enhanced functionality on the ebook side, the question I've got is, does the enhanced functionality basically go, and I'm going to say this, hand in glove with the genre of the book? For instance, if I have a cookbook, would I like somebody to give me a video demonstration while I'm preparing a recipe? Is there any correlation to type of book versus ability to embed rich media?
I think what we're seeing is maybe a little different from that. I think in general, with the readers that we've surveyed, we've seen kind of just a lack of interest in the sort of functionality generally and in the sort of in even reading the sort of books where it might work well in digital formats. So those readers who are interested in something like a cookbook are tending to stick with print for that genre rather than being interested in a kind of high-quality enhanced ebook that might fare better than just a PDF replica of that cookbook. They seem to almost outright prefer print for those genres, and we see that reflected in sales too, like cookbooks, graphic novels. Those are all areas where we haven't seen a lot of publisher revenue coming from digital formats either.
Now, one other question. In the consumer survey, where did religious content fall?
That's another format we haven't seen religious content moving as quickly digital either. It's important when you look at these slides, remember this is a survey of ebook readers only, so those areas where ebooks haven't taken off as well, they might not end up in the survey because we are filtering out for just ebook readers. So religion we've continued to see do better in print, as well as kind of doing better in non-traditional sales channels like direct-to-consumer or not traditional bookstores. We tend to see sales there for religion.
Okay.
So I just wanted to close on a note that I think would be a good place to move on to our next speaker, and which I think is actually more good news for all of us. One of the questions we asked the readers we surveyed was whether they're willing to pay more for an ebook if it comes from a traditional publisher, as opposed to one that was self-published, for example. And we found that to be perfectly frank, most of them either don't know or don't care. We think that these readers are just looking for those great, engaging reading experiences, and ultimately, they don't really care where they come from. They don't care whether they're on paper or screen. If you can create that reading experience that truly engages these readers, you'll continue to fare well in this business no matter what formats you're publishing in. So I think there is still a lot of opportunity here for everyone. I will wrap up there unless there's any more questions. But,
I got a couple more quick questions for you.
Sure.
Nadine, you mentioned price, and you had an average price, and I'm going to misquote them, but of roughly $10 for a printed book and $6 for an ebook. Was that the list price, or was in terms of how you look at that market, the pricing in the market?
No, it's the publisher net price. So it's the average amount a publisher earns. It's not the list price or the retail price.
Okay. And then when you look at the ebook versus print, it's clear that obviously print is not dead. But when we look at where the market is today and you kind of look at 2013, when you look forward, one of the other questions we got was what does BISG think of future projected rates of adoption? Do you do any work in that area?
It's actually an area where we haven't done anything, but where we hope to in the coming year. We've actually been looking to launch a forecasting project where we would kind of try to draw those trends out over the next 5 years or so. But at this point, it's not really something we've looked at. We pretty much have just been tracking the past few years.
And then one other quick question, and I'm sure this will come up again with a couple of our other speakers, but historically we've heard a lot of information and insight and data on customized content where I'll pick the education market, where I'm pulling chapters from books and creating a custom book. Have you done any work in that area to look at how prevalent or non-prevalent that is in the marketplace today?
Yeah, actually the education market is probably where we've done the most research around that. We actually do a survey of students and faculty and their attitudes toward course material, content, and adoptions, and that is something we've seen increasing a bit. We're definitely seeing a shift there towards away from kind of the traditional textbook and towards a mix of other sorts of content replacing it. So that might be digital. It might be custom course packs. It could be a number of different things. But I know that's something that does seem to be taking off, particularly for that market.
Okay. Well, great. Thank you very much, Nadine. And now what we're going to do is get a little different perspective. And what we've got is Angela Bull, who's going to talk to you about the Independent Book Publishers Association and how they're adopting emerging technology. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Angela.
Thank you very much. It's really great to be here. Thanks, Nadine, for all of the background information, too. Again, I'm Angela Bull. I'm the Executive Director for the Independent Book Publishers Association. IBPA, for those of you who don't know, we've been in the industry a long time. Our association started 30 years ago as a cooperative marketing association, which was then called the Publishers Marketing Association, under the idea that by banding together as an industry or a segment of our industry, we could really help level the playing field for indie presses and self-published authors. So we're the largest nonprofit trade association for publishers in the United States, and our mission is to lead and serve the independent publishing community by providing advocacy, education, and tools for success. As a business, we believe that the essence of leadership is service, and we're built on the philosophy that small presses and self-published authors can help each other achieve and succeed. So that's really where we work and what we do as a service organization. We're also, though, a professional association, and a lot of times people ask, well, who are the members of IBPA? And today I'm going to tell you a little bit about our membership base, who makes up our membership base, and what their concerns are related to POD versus offset, related to production issues. And I can say that as a professional association, we do have a code of ethics for our members that we ask them to consider before they sign on. Again, we have got about 3,000 members in membership as of today. And the number one thing here is the one to kind of look at in regards to what we're talking about, that our members come into IBPA not because they're hobbyists and they just want to get their work out, but because they want to be professional in the business of publishing and uphold the highest standards of production excellence. So today we're going to talk a little bit about when I talk to some of our members, when they call the office and they ask for our advice on POD versus offset, who should we go with, and what are the differences, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I tell them. And that way you can kind of get a sense of who they are and what they hear. So the first thing is to kind of look at why on-demand technology is important to our members. Nadine did a really good job of talking about the industry as a whole, and I'm really happy to hear that at the end of the supply chain, the consumer is less interested in who produces the book as they are in the content of the book. I think that we talk about that a lot, and we think that's really important. But for our membership profile, we did a member survey back in March 2014, and we do one of these every year. It's fairly representative. We got about 12% response rate. And essentially what you're looking at when you're considering this market is a lot of self-publishing. 41% of our members are self-publishers, and a lot of general trade publishing as well. They are very small. They have one employee or maybe five employees for the most part, so they wear many, many hats in this industry, and they need strong partners in order to get the business done that needs to get done. And for the most part, they're personally financed. So we don't have a lot in our membership. They don't go out and get loans in order to, or have lines of credit in order to have huge amounts of money on hand to run their businesses. Every dime they spend is a dime that they pull from their pocket. So, of course, all of us on the call are savvy enough to start putting the pieces together. Why would a POD option be interesting to a membership profile like this? Another thing in our membership is, this is a question that we ask them, what do you consider success? I asked my fellow panelists before the call, what do you think that for a general trade publisher, a New York-based general trade publisher, what is successful unit sales? And we thought, well, maybe 10,000 you'd have to sell to consider yourself a good middleist title. But for our members, it can be a lot lower than that, and this is a lot to do with the fact that they have strict cost controls, and they don't line up all of the cost for their product at the very front of the deal. They really are able to spread that out. So, again, for our members, selling 1,000 to 2,000 books can be successful for many, and then for a quarter of them, they do sit in that mid-list range of 5,000 to about 20,000 books. And again, we're working with dollars that are smaller than what you might typically see at a larger house. Most of our members sold less than $10,000 in books last year. This is from 2013. And some sold more than that. So we've got a lot of people in this business. Nadine mentioned there was 60,000 publishers, most of whom are small. And this is representative of how small, I'd say, that they're making a living in some cases. In some cases, they're subsidizing their living.
Hey, Angela, just a quick question. You mentioned that about 30% of the members were in the trade book segment. Mm-hmm. What's the breakdown for the rest of the population? Or do you have, roughly, is it education? Is it, is there any breakdown in terms of what the other areas are, the other 70% look like?
Yeah, I can pull some out and even send it out to the others. It gets a little more specific. We've got a lot of children's, which I know is also a part of trade, but we kind of broke that out too as a separate segment. but for the most part, we don't have a ton of education publishers in our membership. And we don't have a lot of graphic novel and comic publishers in our membership, which is something we looked at a couple months ago. We thought we might, but we don't. But I can pull those numbers and send them out after. We're actually going to release all of this data from our March member survey in August to the industry, so you can get a sense of it.
Great. Thanks, Angela.
You're welcome. So when a member calls our office, and they often do, and they say, what should we do? And we talk to them about that very honestly. So there's three things that we say. As an indie, you're a good candidate for POD across three different categories. And I wanted to also mention to you some limiting factors, some of the things that we say to them when we talk about these things too. So the first is, you're a good candidate if your book is a standard size. John, our next speaker, is going to talk a lot about the different setups and offset and things like that. But from what we've seen our members come in, we've had some of them say, well, I can't do POD because I have a non-standard size book. So that absolutely needs to be the case because it's representative of the content, or however that works. If you have to publish something, if it has to be published in a certain size and it's non-standard, then POD might not work for you. Another example is a member who called the office last week and said she wanted to go POD, but the POD provider didn't offer her the option of printing the title on the spine. And another interesting thing is, we do talk about our members related to getting a distributor, that many distributors will say to them, we can't take your book unless you have the title printed on the spine, because most titles actually sit on bookshelves, not face out, but spine out. So title on spine is an issue, and a lot of POD providers don't offer that as an option. So you're a good candidate if your book is a standard size. You can print the title on the spine for that standard size, and it will work well for you. Again, the book's format doesn't rely on photographs or other illustrations. I would say that I've ordered the POD samples from all of the different companies I can think of, so we can recommend the right options for our members, and it's gotten a lot better. It's actually a really viable choice, and from almost every provider that's doing POD, it's a very viable choice. But you're still going to want to gauge that yourself and get the samples in and understand how your graphics are going to render well in a POD environment, because it is going to be different from an offset environment. And the last one is, if you don't anticipate widely distributing to bricks and mortar stores, it's been the case that bricks and mortar stores, Barnes & Noble, and a lot of the independents have had a little bit of a stigma against POD, and they haven't ordered them as much or en masse or even at all as they have ordered regular books or offset printed books. I guess all the books are regular, aren't they? It's become less of an issue because over 50% of book sales occurred online last year. So obviously it's less of a concern to get into the bookstores as it maybe was at one time. But, of course, everyone does want to be in the bookstores. And most of them now will order POD titles from organizations like Ingram and Lightning Source and others. Like, John will talk a little bit about that. Although some still boycott POD from Amazon or CreateSpace. And I'll also say, if you're looking at POD, you do need to think about how it's going to be, the availability is going to be made online. Sometimes some online sellers will mark a POD title as out of stock or limited availability, or will ship to you in 16 days. And for an indie press whose life's blood comes in on every dime, that can be a very, very much a limiting factor to their business. So all of this is about understanding the different options that are available and understanding all the different limiting factors that come with the option that you choose, and then choosing the best option for your particular book. When we ask our members, why do you love POD? And I will say that the majority of them do choose this as their option. It's not going to surprise, I think, anybody on the call why our members love POD. It saves them money for the most part. It saves them space. And it saves on returns. I think a return rate on traditionally published and distributed books can be between 25-30%, maybe higher. So it will save you money to go the POD route. But again, you have to consider the limiting factors that we spoke about on the last slide and understand them in case you run up against them, should you choose this as an option for you. If you're going to be printing more than 500, 750, maybe 1,000 books, I think the offset printing or something like that is a great option. But if you're looking at other things like saving money or saving space or saving on returns, or you're just not going to be printing in those kinds of quantities or need to have all that stock on hand, then POD is a great option for a lot of our members as well. So that's kind of what I wanted to go through. Happy to answer any questions or turn over to the next speaker.
I've got a couple for you. We've got a couple of folks that clearly are providers of POD services. And so one of the questions that came in, Angela, is if I'm a service provider out in the marketplace, how do I reach out to your constituency and let them know that I exist and that I'm a good provider?
Great, because we need partners. I'll say that we work with independent publishing, but the idea that you publish independently is a complete misnomer. It's all about partnerships and good partnerships. So we've got benefit per member benefit programs. We have vendor programs. We've got directory and service directories, other things like that. I would recommend you contact me. My name's on the slide here, and I can reference to you all the different opportunities that we have.
Great. Thank you. Now, the second question is, you mentioned and you talked about POD a lot, but if I'm a service provider and want to reach into this market space, is there an expectation on the part of your constituency that simultaneously the provider will be able to produce an ebook?
I don't think there's an expectation. I think that is a question they will ask and they'll want to understand. I think that being for our members to be able to consolidate their business in particular service providers with particular service providers is always a good thing, quote unquote, because it's usually just them. So for them to navigate through multiple different business arrangements with lots of different companies to get a title out, it could be a little bit less interesting to them in that way. But we actually advocate they use a POD provider that can distribute digital books everywhere but Amazon, and then maybe just go through Amazon to distribute through them. That's been a recommendation a lot of our members have seen success with. So they can cherry pick and often do cherry pick. It'll be a decision for them.
Okay. Well, great. Thank you very much. And now what I'm going to do is we're going to turn over to John Edwards, and John's going to talk a bit about the manufacturing side and share a manufacturing perspective relative to on-demand technology. So, John, take it away.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is John Edwards. I'm the president of Edwards Brothers Malloy. We're based in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Edwards Brothers Malloy is a company that became one about 3 years ago, a merger between Edwards Brothers and the Malloy companies. Edwards Brothers was established in 1893, so way before ebooks, and Malloy was established in 1960. We believe we're the fifth largest manufacturer. We have about 700 employees. And one of the stats that I'm most proud of is we have about 150 people with more than 25 years with the company. So a lot of people come to our company and stay a long time. Just kind of a quick snapshot of what we do, where we're located. We're short to medium run book manufacturers. We have four offset facilities. We're in the process of consolidating our plants in Ann Arbor. About 500,000 square feet of manufacturing space. Also, we run a fulfillment operation, and we do digital printing in the remote locations, example in California, North Carolina, New Jersey, Chicago area. So we run printing facilities inside some publishers' warehouses as well. Some of the trends and challenges. I don't think I'm going to say what most of you don't already know, but we know that overall print volumes are declining. It was nice to see flat is the new up. That's a phrase I've been using for a number of years, actually. Print runs are getting smaller. We know that. Continuing pressure to keep costs down. And I think what the publishing community is seeing, as the printing community is seeing, is we have to do more with less. We've got to figure out how do we do more titles with less people, how do we automate the process, how do we process orders as efficiently as possible. So this is some data from InterQuest, which just kind of shows the overall decline in print volume. Because I think when you look at trade sales numbers, it doesn't necessarily reflect units, because publishers can raise prices, and that may not be an indication of what's happening to the units. So that's how we look at it. Some of the challenges that we're seeing is, the migration to digital printing. Is it going to be okay? Is it going to be good enough quality? Is it fast enough? And we've seen that in our world that our digital footprint has grown. It grows about 15% a year, and we've been in the digital business since 1997. With that said, 25% of our business is digital printing, and 75% is offset. So we still are a pretty good size offset manufacturer. We have 13 Timpson web presses that run all the time. And we are getting it. We have inkjet printing as well. So we have toner-based printing, inkjet. We have sheet-fed offset printing as well as web printing. So we do all the different kinds of output. Just to give you a little snapshot of offset versus toner versus inkjet, you hear a lot of people say, when does it make sense to go digital? When does POD make sense? And I think you'll get different answers from every printer you talk to because a lot of it is based on the equipment that they have. We have offset, digital, and inkjet, so I can speak to all of those different buckets. On the offset side, which again is the biggest part of our business, you want your runs to be a little bit longer. Make-ready costs become significant on short runs. It can take a little bit longer because you got to burn plates, you got to print it, you got to bind it. Those are three different operations. We get a different number. We generally go over 300 on our offset equipment. It is the best quality, best color reproduction. The next one is digital toner, which is kind of the other end, which is lower quantities yet. It has pretty good quality, come a long way in the last few years. The color is really good. Many paper options, almost the same as you can run on the offset presses. And, we're doing photo book quality products on those machines. Kind of what's in between is the inkjet, number of manufacturers out there. We tend to run the longer quantities on the inkjet machine. Black and white is almost indistinguishable. On color, it's not quite as good, but the way I describe it, it's what I call wash color. The colors aren't quite as vibrant. And so some people don't like that. The market that's really embraced the four-color inkjet is the textbook higher ed market. It's suiting that market. Running those big four-color textbooks on a web press is very expensive, and the publishers can go to very low quantities efficiently. So, in our operation, we run offset, toner, and inkjet manufacturing, and it's a real education in terms of what the customer is looking for, what they want. In our world, the trim size doesn't really matter. For example, we have one customer that we did 100 different trim sizes for last year. So we want it to be the same on offset as digital, so you can't tell them apart. And I also want to mention that a majority of the titles that are on our digital machines, not majority, more than half, are titles that were originally on our offset presses. So these are titles that we're extending the life by printing shorter run quantities throughout the life. So my point is that one size does not fit all. Make sure you understand what the manufacturer has. I would say the inkjet quality is good and getting better. Markets are more and more accepting of it, and the savings are significant. It's cheaper. It's significantly less than toner. InterQuest predicts that inkjet will grow at a rate of 40%, and I don't doubt that. So that's an important trend. So these pictures are the top picture's an offset press. The middle one's a cut sheet toner-based machine, and the bottom one's an inkjet press. The future state. Just spend a few minutes on what we see looking ahead. More publishers, especially self-publishers, are continuing to grow. Take from Publishers Weekly, it's grown 400% since 2007. More books are being published. There's really the barriers to entry are pretty darn low. Fewer units are being printed of each. And I think the self-publishing group who's running on a shoestring budget will do a better job of managing their inventory. I also think there'll be fewer printers and as the industry continues to consolidate to keep up with the demand.
Hey, John, I have a quick question for you. Before you move on. When we talk about the print side of it, talk a little bit in terms of what services those publishers are asking you for beyond print.
Well, I would say a lot of the publishers are talking to us about how to help me manage my inventory better. I mean, help me be more responsive to the demand. And that means that they're pushing people like us to be faster and more responsive, which can be difficult in the summertime when we're very busy to be flexible. So, we're working with some publishers, I think I'm going to mention it later, about some piloting some some programs that are basically a hybrid of a micro inventory, very short-run inventory, and print-on-demand. So we can build up a little bit of inventory, and I mean a carton or two, and then be able to immediately respond to the unexpected demand and then replenish to that shelf in very small quantities. So I think that's where publishers and printers are trying to get creative, and, you know, how do you help me, the publisher, be more reactive to an unpredictable market demand while spending a lot of money?
Okay. Great, thanks.
Okay, the next slide kind of talks about more future state discussions, and a phrase we use around here a lot is just-in-time inventory versus just-in-case inventory. So what the publishing community does is they'll order from offset printers like us a couple thousand copies and put it in inventory and have units on hand just in case it sells. And we want to help them, you know, be more just-in-time, so help them run the inventory tighter. You know, don't print a two-year supply. Print a three-month supply, a six-month supply, and chase the demand. And that results in less waste, lower landed cost, but it can be a lot more pain, too, as we're reacting to what happens in the marketplace. And that can move to auto-replenishment programs where we're connected with the publisher's inventory, and when they hit certain trigger points, it automatically generates an order, and no production person has to touch it. Our customer service team doesn't have to touch it. And then that moves to a print-on-demand or zero inventory. You know, print to what the forecasted demand is or the actual unit sales demand is, and then go print-on-demand after that. So if you have a couple hundred units that are sold, make those, and they just go on demand after that. Then you can have never out of stock, never miss a sale. As we move to the next slide, more future state. You know, I think you're going to see more compression of the supply chain. I mean, if you think about what a physical book has to do to go from a printing plant to the end user, it's a lot. And so we talk in our four walls about how do you have the consumer talk to our print engine? I mean, that's really where you want to be. So how do you ingest that order, pull the file, move it to the print engine with everything we need to know to make that title in the quickest way possible? So, you know, I see us getting more involved into the supply chain and inventory systems tying us together. It minimizes inventory. We can reduce freight costs and be more responsive to the marketplace. And I see publishers doing more of the sales directly on their website. You see all of the press the last couple of weeks about Amazon versus Hachette. You know, I think that people are a little nervous about how big and powerful Amazon is and how do you get more control of who you sell it to and how you sell it. But you can see in this graph that, which I stole from BISG and AAP, was, you know, people are getting their books in a lot of different ways now. It's not just go to your Barnes & Noble and buy it. I mean, there's a lot of different ways to get your books, and I think what I heard was 50% are bought online. So there's other ways to capture that sale.
John, as long as you brought it up, we got a question that came in from one of our participants, and the question was, what's your perspective on the role that Amazon will play as a distributed printer in the future, considering the extent of their footprint and growing distribution centers and same-day delivery?
Well, we feel the pressure of Amazon like the publishers feel the pressure of Amazon. I mean, I think that they're going to continue to muscle their way into the things that the traditional printing community does, and we just had to try to find ways to be more valuable. But I think a lot of times people like us are in the business because we're not them.
Okay, good.
Does that make sense?
Yep.
More future state stuff, you know, focusing on how do you execute transactions in an automated way to get all the touches out. Because if you're doing an order for 5 units, as soon as somebody touches it, you can't make money. So it's more automated ordering through EDI feeds, web portals. We have this is a particular portal that we use called mybmalloy.com where customers can come in and order their books and just take out all the personal touches on those transactions so it can be done quicker and more cost effectively. And I think on the publishing side, you know, nobody's getting more staff on the production side. The order velocity is going through the roof, and any automation that we can provide will make their lives a lot easier. Also, we are, you know, focusing on print local, so how do you make that book closer to the end user? Because the freight can sometimes be more than the printing cost. And we have partners in the UK, Australia, and Singapore where we can ingest an order in Ann Arbor and produce it anywhere in those locations almost immediately. Continuing on to practical suggestions, you know, seriously consider printing fewer books more often. Look beyond the unit cost and consider the cost of the unsold inventory. It's a dumb and simple graph here. It just shows, You print 750 books and sell 400 versus printing 400 and selling 400. Your unit rate is obviously more at 400 versus 700, but when you factor in the cost of the unsold units and the sold units, you're actually paying more per sold unit. So that's an area that we spend a lot of time, you know, trying to understand the true landed cost, the true cost of the unit sold, to really utilize the short run of the digital technology to help our customers make better decisions. Another one is, you know, plan your digital printing. When you put a new title in, plan it so it'll seamlessly move into the digital arena. Some of the digital presses can't run all the papers that the offsets can. So if you envision this title going into a digital environment, make sure that the papers are seamless, or be okay with the fact that the bulk might change a little bit. It might look a little bit different. Keep close tabs on your archive. Your archives could be money if you can make it available to the marketplace. And shamelessly self-promoting, print a publisher, the printer that can do everything. More is put your backlist into play again. You know, with the internet, you can make it available pretty ineffectively. As you work with the supplier, negotiate scanning prep fees so that you can keep those costs down. And we do a lot of cases where we'll scan titles and put them in the archive and make them available. Help people make them available for sale. And think about how you get your book into the reader's hands with as few touches as possible. And phrases that we use in our four walls a lot are compressive supply chain, automated and semi-automated ordering options, auto-replenishment where the warehouse will trigger an order, and then print-on-demand, and print-on-demand can be part of all of those things. And that's it. There's my information if you want to reach out to me.
Yeah, no, couple of quick questions here. When you take a look at the you mentioned, you know, the ability to auto replenish and those kinds of things. What typical offset run length, and I know there's not a typical, but what typical run lengths would you traditionally do an offset in terms of min-maxes? And then take me through what the min-max would be for digital devices, inkjet and electrophotographic again. One of the folks that basically wanted to just touch base and understand that again in terms of how you make those decisions.
Sure. Well, since we have toner, inkjet, sheetfed, and web, you know, to me they're all just output devices. So we're trying to maximize the throughput on all those machines all the time. But generally, the toner machines, the cut sheet toner machines, go up to a couple hundred. The inkjets go up to 500 to 750, depending on the page count. At about 500, the sheetfed offset presses kick in. And at about 1,000 to 1,500, our web presses kick in. Now, with that said, we could be running a 5,000-copy run on a sheet-fed press or a 1,000-copy run on a cut-sheet machine if it'll get it through the plant faster. But those are kind of the basic rules that we use.
Are there any finishing considerations predicated on the different technologies? You know, soft-cover books, hard-cover books. Are there any considerations you make on the finishing side?
Well, if it's a sewn book, for offset sewn, we do not sew in the digital arena. Another thing we sew, it'll just get converted to an adhesive case hardbound product. Another area that's complicated is if it's a book with some heavy stamping, decorating cloth on the hardbound book, replicating that in a POD environment can be pretty clumsy because the stamping die can be $50 or $60. So what we do with a lot of our publishers is they'll just use a printed cover and replicate that design when they go into a POD. So we sort of counsel them on how to make it seamless. If some papers aren't available, we may adjust the bulk and move it to a different paper. So we'll try to be flexible to help keep that title alive, because that's really, if we can do that, everybody wins.
Okay. Well, I'm going to wrap up, and I'll check one more time for questions, but I'll just wrap up with a couple of recommendations and conclusions. I think what you heard today from all of our speakers is that consumers are really in control of how they access content. That print is very much alive, but digital editions are here to stay. That the digital revolution has really unlocked an entirely new field of production to self-publishers, self-publishing authors and independent publishers. I think we're seeing, and when you look at Nadine's numbers and Angela's numbers, that independent publishers are the new normal. And, you know, they're dependent upon technologies like on-demand and digital print technologies. And I think what you're hearing from John is that there are manufacturers out there that stand ready to simultaneously prepare digital and printed editions, as well as give you options for doing traditional and long run lengths all the way through to the very short run lengths. And so what you're seeing is, you know, content is really intersecting with technology. You know, the content is going to reign, but publishers really need to take the time to determine the very best way to satisfy readers. And it might be, you know, getting a book in front of them at just the right moment, or it may be getting a book to them the next day. You're going to see books continue to be more interactive and engaging. They'll start using more and more rich media. And those types of things will be integrated across all technology platforms. And so when you think about the book market, what I tell everybody is I think Yogi Berra had it right when he said, you know, the future ain't what it used to be. Now, I'd like to take the time to really thank all of our speakers. And if we didn't get to your question, we will get back to you. Again, thanks so much for your time and attention, and thanks to Nadine, John, and Angela. Have a great rest of the day.